This lecture is part of a three-part series. It's, I hope, intelligible in itself, the third part of which you have for the Thursday colloquium that David Welbery and I will be doing. So you missed the middle part, but I think the both today and on Thursday, the lectures are relatively self-contained. In trying to give a preliminary account of what I'm trying to do, only two things came to mind. One is the old line by Croce, which would imply that what I'm trying to do is resurrect a dead dog, Hegel. Perhaps two dead dogs, Hegel and the now, for many people, dead question of modernism. The other way of characterizing it is the American expression, kick a dead horse. Well, I'm about to try to dig up two and ride them. In this lecture, because I don't believe the Hegelian alternative has been given the full play it deserves. In 1863, the French painter Edouard Manet caused a public scandal when he exhibited his large painting, Déjeuner sur l'herbe, in the Salon des Refusés. If we dimmed all the lights, they couldn't film, but this is just slightly washed out. It's a much deeper, richer green, if you've ever seen it. That's going to be true of all the paintings. They're considerably washed out by this light. He caused an even greater scandal 2 years later when he exhibited the startling Olympia in the Paris Salon, an enormous scandal, lasted for months. The nature of and the reasons for the controversy have been told several times from a number of points of view by distinguished art historians. In hindsight, it seemed to many of these commentators that something unprecedented and revolutionary in the history of painting began with Manet, a development that would eventually coalesce into what came to be characterized as a movement or epoch in virtually all the arts, modernism. Of course, Manet did not spring ex nihilo into history and did not simply begin modernism. The narrative that we need for modernist painting begins with the reaction against the Rococo in the 1750s and became something truly revolutionary only after the impact of Impressionism in the 1870s. This is a long story, but only a few would now deny that Manet is the pivotal figure. Whether there is anything to such a categorization or not, and periodization in art history is notoriously controversial, the mise-en-scène, the technique, and something like the mood or tonality in each painting is so odd that something uncanny and unprecedented is clearly going on, something that seems to be about and a challenge to painting itself, to the conventions of meaning in easel painting. Normal perceptual apprehension and representational understanding is not so much intensified as we might expect in a great work of art, as it is rather in some way interrupted and challenged for reasons that were clear to almost no one at the time. For one thing, each of the two paintings invokes a traditional source in order, it would appear, to quote, problematize, or place in some sort of suspension the previous attempt, Raimondi's either late 16th or early 17th century engraving after a lost painting by Raphael, The Judgment of Paris, and the echo is clear, and for Olympia, Titian's Venus d'Urbino. The challenge to us and to painting is clear in the startling looks of the two women, the same woman, actually, Victorine Meurent, Manet's favorite model. Looks that all at once destroy the convention of pictorial illusionism, the illusion that we are looking into a three-dimensional space and not at a flat painted rectangle, seem to address the beholder of the painting, not the scene, with a confrontational challenge, as if to ask just what is it you're looking for, and which thereby also thematize the painting's facing position opposite the beholder, suggesting questions about the psychology of meaningful beholding and the status of the social conventions assumed in understanding the point of easel paintings themselves. There are famously all sorts of somewhat violent challenges to pictorial conventions in, for example, the Déjeuner. This is the woman in the background of the Déjeuner, and you can see right away, I hope you can see, even if you're way in the back, that her size is all wrong, that she does not obey the laws of vanishing point perspective, and she's too big, and it's very unclear as well what exactly she's doing and why, so there's a kind of mystery to the narrative. Some people suggest there's clearly something post-coital going on, but that's not at all clear. The conversational relationships of the men who are talking are not to each other. He's not looking, if you could see the whole picture again, at the man he's talking to, and the other man is not looking at him at all. It doesn't appear even to be listening. So they're There's something strange in the conversation. There are these little details, like a very well-defined bird in the upper slightly right quadrant of the painting, and then in the lower left quadrant, a tiny frog, as if Manet is playing around with iconography in ways that are clearly unreadable. They have no traditional echo in anything else. I mean, many of you will also appreciate immediately that these are coded for, wait a minute, going the wrong way, sorry, coded for gender and class. And unfortunately, my second lecture concerns, since Manet is in both of these paintings clearly painting in, and I would say clearly trying to destroy, the tradition of the nude in painting from the 17th and 18th century. And in the Olympia, it's taken for granted now by almost everyone that Olympia is a courtesan, a prostitute, a kind of prostitute that resides in a brothel, not a street prostitute, but for whom the illusions and theater of courtship and seduction are required as a matter of convention. So as I say, coded for gender and class, that she's a prostitute, and that means a lower class woman. And I have a discussion in the second lecture of Tim Clark's analysis of the Olympia and of modernism, which we can talk about in the discussion if you like. The paintings are also a kind of original interrogation Manet had already used to great effect in The Old Musician. They're not strictly coded for gender and class, and you get the same kind of challenging look in The Old Musician of 1860. And other painters were also exploring the same rather violent disruption of the conventions of painterly illusionism. This is Fantin Latour's homage to Delacroix, and this is even more tinged with irony because in the homage to Delacroix, who's painted in the back, none of them are looking at Delacroix, and all of them, almost all of them, are looking directly at us. I am, as will become ever more obvious, neither an art historian nor an art critic, and I will not pretend to be, but I am interested in a kind of philosophical attention to artworks, especially to visual artworks and the meaning of normative change in the history of art. This interest is largely inspired by the approach taken in a series of lectures on fine art given four different times by Hegel in Berlin during the 1820s. Very roughly, Hegel's view was that the production, or as he says, externalization of our ideas in artworks represents a distinct and until very recently indispensable form of self-knowledge. His unusual phrase is that human being, understood as Geist or spirit, must double itself, sich verdoppeln, in order to be able to experience and understand itself in its deeds and objects. And with that one characterization, we are already in uncharted waters. Art does not double or imitate reality, as in so many mimetic theories, but rather in art, Geist, some sort of achieved collected like-mindedness, tries to double itself. And this occurs within an ongoing, collective, continuous attempt at self-knowledge over historical time, a project one had to understand in the light of interconnected attempts at such knowledge in religion, philosophy, and even for Hegel in the social and political practices of an age. Although Hegel was very clear about the differences between the conceptual articulation of this self-knowledge at some level of achievement in philosophy and what he called the intuitive, anschaulich, representations of such self-knowledge in art, his position also had as its consequence a consideration of artworks, and not just epics and great tragedies, but visual and plastic and musical artworks as well, as limited forms of and deeply continuous with philosophy, historically inflected philosophy by other means, let us say. Otherwise expressed, art, at least for most of its existence, had for Hegel a kind of philosophical work to do. In his language, that work was a particular way of what he also called working out, herausarbeiten, modes of self-understanding, with respect to the basic problem all the post-Kantian idealists took to calling the issue of the absolute, the subject-object problem. Acknowledging the great difference between subjects and objects, while denying any metaphysical dualism, was the holy grail of the period. And the problem encompassed everything from how subjects can know objects, how material states and events, especially art objects and bodily movements, could be said to bear meaning, something already implicitly interrogated, that possibility, by those facing looks in Manet, to how reason-responsive subjects could also be material objects in space and time. Hence, the obvious Hegelian question for Manet and for the entire epoch he seems to have had an early role in helping to initiate. Is there anything in the spirit of Hegel that one can say about the sort of self-knowledge realized or worked out in the modernist art produced a generation after Hegel died in 1831? Anything consistent, at least, with the broad spirit, if not the letter, of Hegel's own account of the problem of the absolute. That is, at least in the interpretation of Hegel I would defend, his concession about the utter ontological materiality of human being, and his insistence on the utter unavailability of materialist explanations of spirit practices. Geist. Could that very abstract problematic, the legacy of Kant's third antinomy, Schiller's Letters on the Aesthetic Education of Man, Schelling's 1800 System of Transcendental Idealism, and Schlegel's Reflections on Irony and the Infinite, be of any use in understanding the work of urban French culture in mid-19th century Paris? Hegel had certainly showed that he could put his framework to brilliant use in quite unusual aesthetic contexts. If, for example, the classic Attic tragedies meant what Hegel said they meant, or even simply if it's an interesting idea, that a great crisis in the basic institutions of that society had arisen and could not now be resolved, that contradictory justifications for action had somehow both become fully right, what, if anything, is revealed in some corresponding way about societies whose painters begin to make paintings where objects seem to be dematerializing over historical time in succeeding generations, first as sensory impressions, then as occasions for artistic and often elaborate geometric reconstruction, and finally as absent in wholly non-representational experiments, a society that also makes self-referential and ironic literary works and that makes art music without conventional harmony, eventually melody, and eventually architecture, in which architecture is simply, as it is said, structure. Is it even plausible to try to understand normative change in the practice of art by understanding these alterations within broader social, religious, and even philosophical changes? Could such an approach do justice to the distinctly aesthetic meaning of these innovations, or is it already bordering on some form of thematic reductionism? There are many reasons to be very skeptical that anything of value can result from trying to project Hegel into the future like this. After all, anyone who has heard anything about Hegel has probably heard that he said two things: that philosophy was its own time comprehended in thought, and some summary of the following remark. In these respects, art, considered in its highest vocation, is and remains for us a thing of the past. Thereby, it has lost for us genuine truth and life, and has rather been transferred into our ideas instead of maintaining its earlier necessity in reality and occupying its higher place. What is now aroused in us by works of art is not just immediate enjoyment, but our judgment also, since we are subject to our intellectual consideration, the content of art, and to the work of art's means of presentation and the appropriateness or inappropriateness of both to one another. The philosophy of art is therefore a greater need in our day than it was in days when art by itself as art yielded full satisfaction. Art invites us to intellectual consideration, and that not for the purpose of creating art again, but just for knowing what philosophically art is. If one considers the history of modernist art after Hegel, there is something both ominously prophetic and yet clearly hasty about Hegel's remarks. The tone of pessimism in the remark can seem to us more like something simply obvious. It can seem trivially true that the fine arts could not matter to us as they mattered in the tragic festivals of ancient Athens, or in religious practices, or in the dreams of the cruel antique, his post-Kantian allies and often enemies. And Hegel had not even anticipated two other threats to the vitality and autonomy of art: that an art-buying leisure class of the bourgeoisie would become the principal patrons of the arts, nor did he anticipate how much mass consumer societies would radically alter the conditions for arts production and appreciation. Yet on the other hand, the revolutionary vitality of the modernist moment and the continuing validity and vitality today of art forms like film and photography are evidence enough that art has certainly not become a thing of the past. However, we can begin to see the opening to answer our Hegelian question about pictorial modernism if we recall that this claim about the end of art is not an isolated one in Hegel's books and lectures. After all, Hegel also does not believe that there's any world historical work for philosophy to do. Its content is also its past, now understood in the right way within a comprehensive philosophical system. And there are to be no world historical developments, according to him, in religion either, beyond the doctrinally thin, ethical, humanist Protestantism Hegel preferred. And the institutions of modern ethical life, Sittlichkeit, the distinction between the state and civil society, and the basic structures of modern civil society, all also represent for him the achievement of, in his language, reconciled relations of genuinely mutual recognitional status. That is, Hegel believes what he does about the finality of the achievement of romantic art because he is convinced of all of these other claims as well, not because of some feature of late Romantic art which requires such a reduced significance. According to Hegel, late Romantic art, however much the self-transcendence of art, still enacts such a transcendence as art, but for the last time. Paradigmatically, he believes that the basic structures of modern society had become at least incipiently rational. Romantic art had already embodied the fact that we had liberated ourselves from our natural home and had successfully created another. The modern shape of spirit was a world of freedom realized, or reconciled social relations of persons who are free because they actually stand in relations of at least institutionally secured mutuality of recognition. We have reached a form of self and other understanding where there is nothing substantial left to be worked out. No fundamental residual irrationality in the way we make claims on each other and about the world. In a word, and I will simply assume that this does not need to be argued, this is all clearly false as a claim about European modernity in the first third of the 19th century. And its being false means that the particular failure and the partial success of the modern attempt at the realization of freedom would still require, in Hegel's own terms, an attempt at the sort of understanding just referred to, an objective embodiment and self-recognition, or the world of art. This would be an embodiment both of still unresolved dualities, let us say required but incompatible commitments, and some presentment of their overcoming, but in an aesthetic form responsive to a historical situation Hegel had not properly conceptualized. It should not be surprising, in other words, if there is a connection between Hegel's account of our sense-making practices with respect to the products of Geist altogether, human doings and makings, and his account of the distinct sort of intelligibility required now by aesthetic objects. And since the core of that general account involves a social theory of meaning, the meaning of intentional action, for example, how bodily movements bear meaning, it will not be surprising if that account is also of continuing relevance to the social dimensions of aesthetic meaning, especially with respect to three crucial issues: the relation to the beholder, presumed in different ways at different times in visual art, with respect to the interpretability of the human actions depicted in paintings, and with respect to the artwork itself understood as a result of the action of the painter, clearly dependent on how we understand what actions are. And all of this is of relevance only as historically inflected for a community at a time. So my hypothesis is, if one can understand the persistence of the kind of conflicting commitments in intellectual, cultural, and political life required by rapidly modernizing European societies, the kind Hegel thought had been overcome, one will be in a better position to begin to understand the aesthetic experimentation that seemed to begin with Manet. Hegel, in other words, may have provided the resources for an approach to modernism and a way of understanding at least its relation to the self-knowledge problem without having understood the potential and limitations of his own approach. He may be the theorist of modernism, malgré lui and avant la lettre. These formulations, of course, only gesture at those theoretical resources, and it would take several books to spell them out. But at the heart of the matter, the central claim of Hegel's idealism anticipates in its very formulation the issue of the conditions of the possibility of the intelligibility of fine art in general, and giving the increasing pressure modernist art places on conceptual articulation, or what we now call criticism, for modernist art and criticism in particular. That central claim requires both the, and I apologize for the breathlessness of this summary. I hope it rings some faint bell in some former course in German philosophy that you read, but I have no choice but to go through this very rapidly. The central claim requires both the distinguishability and, more radically, the inseparability of concept and intuition in experience. And similarly, a form of practical mindedness in tensions in bodily movement and action. These two aspects of Hegel are his major contributions to philosophy. And as I said, my conscience will bother me forever about this succeeding summary. Hegel denied that the basic categories, capacities, needed to understand what we experience and what we do, active and passive categories, were congruent with the notions of spontaneity and receptivity, respectively. He maintained that, especially, any passivity, sensual passivity and openness to the world, was itself always already determined, in a way, with spontaneous discrimination. This claim required a massive reconsideration of the very possibility of intelligibility in experience and action, Hegel's major project, and they met a major disagreement with, even as he was enormously influenced by, Kant's original arguments about how thoughts can be said to inform sensibility, and how thoughts could be said to be in, be at work in, the bodily movements we count as ascribable actions. In aesthetic terms, and this is really the important part, this position required of Hegel a rejection of rationalist, classicist, and perfectionist aesthetics, in which separable ideas are dimly, if pleasantly, intimated in sensuous experience. Empiricist aesthetics, where sensual pleasure on its own is considered a directly reactive phenomenon. And Kantian and even Schillerian aesthetics, where the harmony or free play of faculties intimates a purposiveness, but one that cannot be rendered at all conceptually determinate. This issue is all over the place in discussions of modernist aesthetics and by modernist artists. Consider only this Hegelian remark about his painterly ideal by Matisse in one of his letters. The ideal, to give yourself completely to what you're doing while simultaneously watching yourself do it. I mean, it's as if he was reading the Critique of Pure Reason and not terribly well understanding it, but the ideal he's evoking, the possibility of this sensuous immediacy at the same time that there's a reflective level that isn't in tension with it, speaks volumes about the course of this influence throughout the 19th century. The vast theoretical pendulum swings that all of you are more aware of than I am in post-60s theory between materiality as such of various sorts, of a Marxist, neo-Marxist, or Lacanian sort, and absolute linguisticality or textuality, as in semiotics of various stripes or deconstruction, are already on view in Matisse's quotation and its origins in the idealist tradition, and they're descended from the original disagreement between Kant and Hegel on the relationship between concept and intuition, thought and its sensual embodiment. As we shall see, the position especially associates the intelligibility of artworks with the kind of intelligibility had by bodily movements we count as actions, where successfully circulating social norms are necessary for the content and the ascribability of the action to be fixed. So one question that will emerge in our counterfactual exploration of what would be Hegel's account of Manet is what such a requirement looks like, literally looks like, when those norms begin to break down internally and lose their grip. So let us return to the striking claim that art has become for us ein Vergangenes, a thing of the past, not capable of functioning for us with the power and importance it once had. Of course, by claiming this, Hegel did not mean that art will not be produced, or that it will be somehow discredited, like astrology or alchemy, or that it will come to seem a primitive version of philosophy. To understand what he means, we have to recall that Hegel's treatment of art itself, in whatever period, had already throughout all the lectures steered fairly clear of many of the traditional aesthetic categories. When he is discussing the notion of true beauty, for example, he says such unusual things as, works of art are all the more excellent in expressing true beauty, the deeper is the inner truth of their content and thought. This is not a form of classicism, because Hegel does not, as we'll see in a minute, Hegel does not consider artworks to be the representations of an independent objective ideal, the truth in the normal sense, but as we'll see, as vehicles for the practical realization of the relevant speculative truth. Partly this is because of what he believes about the unique logical status of the self-knowledge embodied in artworks, even at this collective or civilizational level. And this is another crucial theoretical presupposition of the lectures that requires an all too brief gloss. Whether as collective or individual such self-knowledge, whether as collective or individual, such self-knowledge does not take an object in the usual intentional sense. What we take ourselves to be is as much an avowal or commitment, a pledge about what we will keep faith with, and it is not a simple self-acknowledgement. Or self-knowledge is self-constituting in Hegel as we collectively struggle actually to become who we take ourselves to be. This feature of self-knowledge has an even more important implication. Here is the passage where Hegel distinguishes himself from traditional classicism in the clearest terms, and one of the most important in all of Hegel, I think. He is discussing classical art, naturally the favorite period for classicist theories, and he notes something about the way classical art should be said to reveal the truth. What he says here is extremely important, for it not only distinguishes his position from traditional classicism, but he is relying on the same logical structure in understanding the expressive and actualizing function of artworks as he does in the understanding of the relation between subjective mindedness and a public deed, a connection, as we will soon see, crucial to his approach and connected to the problem described above as the idealist problem of the absolute. Here's the quotation. "And it was not as if these ideas and doctrines were already there in advance of poetry, in an abstract mode of consciousness, as general religious propositions and categories of thought, and then later were only clothed in imagery by artists and given an external adornment in poetry. On the contrary, the mode of artistic production was such that what fermented in these poets they could work out only in this form of art and poetry." There's a great deal more to say about that very interesting phrase again, herauszuarbeiten, to work out. For one thing, this way of talking makes clear why Hegel might think that the externalization of our ideas about ourselves in artworks is essential, not merely exemplifying. We don't know in any determinate or living detail whom we take ourselves to be, except in such externalization, either in action or in material production or in creative art. As he says, there are no ideas or doctrines before art, but only first in art. As just noted, in the case of individual self-knowledge, this knowledge is inherently first and not third personal, and not observational, in other words, and it is self-constituting, cannot be a mere self-discovery or self-report. In any significant sense of self-knowledge, beyond a report of empirical facts, the sense relevant to what philosophers sometimes call our practical identity, where what I am is a practicing Christian or atheist or political liberal or devoted father, we are, in that sense, at least provisionally, what we take ourselves to be. I say provisionally because Hegel adds to this self-constitution notion the claim that such avowals are real, wirklich, only as realized, verwirklicht, in a world at a time. He agrees with Goethe that in the beginning was the deed, that the deed is the measure of the genuineness and indeed the true content of a subject's inner commitments. Hegel also adds to this picture of self-knowledge the controversial notion that something like our collective identity, Geist again, is distinct from the mere sum of or is not some mere function of individual avowals. The common and the individual are famously for him dialectically intertwined, and the common project is subject to the same logic. That is, any such individually self-constituting practical identity is not possible except within a continuing effort at a commonly achieved self-knowledge and so self-realization. It is the very broadest of such projects at commonly realized self-knowledge that we are asking about, the modern. There's much more to say about this point, but it's the most important Hegelian contribution to a theory of art, and we'll be returning to it frequently. Secondly, when Hegel notes that in our age, art invites us, quote, art invites us to intellectual consideration, and that not for the purpose of creating art again, but for knowing philosophically what art is, he is not only already undermining his own narrow account of art appreciation as essentially intuitive and affective, he could easily be taken to be introducing the possibility of a different sort of art up to this new expectation, not just cataloging our different expectations and needs, an art of the explicitly self-reflexive sort one begins to see with Manet, an art requiring from the beholder interpretive interrogation of a new sort. Such an interrogation of a new sort is the target of our inquiry, but now framed more determinately by these notions of provisional self-avowals, externalization, and realization. This is suggested in many rich but not well worked out claims by Hegel, like, quote, "In this way, romantic art is the self-transcendence of art," but again he says, "within its own sphere and in the form of art itself," as well as in his claim that for us now, art provokes a philosophy of art, or what he calls a scientific treatment, and not so much a distinct aesthetic sensual pleasure, although not in the total absence of that. That's still the primary mode of aesthetic intelligibility. Moreover, Hegel also notes that the situation of the modern artist, by which he means basically late Romantic art, has liberated the artist from the burden of any dependence on a received national or religious or artistic tradition. There is nothing any longer in either sense that the artist is bound to take up on pain of falling outside what is recognized as conforming to the norm, art. As Hegel says frequently in the lectures, in a way that almost sounds like a celebration of postmodernism, for the contemporary artist, anything from the past is available, any style, any tradition, technique, any theme or topic. Admittedly, these suggestions about Hegel's initial relevance come at the price of reconfiguring some of his own formulations. There are two serious divergences, and both have to do with what I believe to be inherent finally, unresolvable tensions in Hegel's account. The first concerns something I want to count as a great virtue of his approach, the absence of an essentialist and the promotion of a historicist approach. Art, in other words, is not a natural human kind, no more than opera or film is. It is a practice invented under certain conditions, sharing properties with other similar practices like decoration, political self-glorification, religious rituals, and so forth. But Hegel wants to count it as a distinctive practice. Its norms are collectively self-legislated over time, in other words, in the same basic way, to speak very crudely, that the rules for a game could be formulated collectively over changes in time. Such rules, once the game starts, are not arbitrarily formulated and can even be said to have a kind of internal necessity, given in the larger sense in which this is an image, given the large-scale project of self-knowledge attributed to Hegel earlier, and his argument for the indispensability of some form of affective and sensual understanding, perhaps an intuitively oriented conceptual interpretation. That is, Hegel may think that there are a priori reasons for there being art, the reason just cited. Any adequate understanding of the absolute must include an intuitive understanding. But the spirit of his enterprise should mean that there cannot be any a priori reason to exclude post-Romantic art from the tradition of art. It would obviously be more consistent to say that art can come to be something quite novel under the novel historical conditions of modernity, perhaps so novel as not to be recognizable to anyone in the prior tradition as art. The fact that Hegel thinks that any art that does not conform to what had been understood as the task of an intuitive manifestation of the absolute should no longer be counted as art not only betrays an odd essentialism, but it blocks a consideration of the fairly natural way that his remarks about the fate of Romantic art open up onto the distinctive features of modernist art, as his own remarks about a new philosophical treatment suggest. The extraordinary difficulty of this position, the more historicist one, is that we still want, or at least I still want, to be able to retain the ability to say that something can now pose as art and not be art, that it can be historically produced and viewed as art, be treated by art as the relevant authorities, and yet still not be art. That's an issue perhaps we can return to in the discussion. The second revision required to make Hegel more Hegelian involves passages like the following. Art, by means of its representations, while remaining within the sensuous sphere, and here Hegel at his most triumphalist, liberates man at the same time from the power of sensuousness. Of course, we may often hear favorite phraseology about man's duty to remain in immediate unity with nature, but such unity in its abstraction is purely and simply rudeness or roughness and ferocity. It's barbaric, in other words. And by dissolving this unity for man, art lifts him with gentle hands out of and above imprisonment in nature. Well, there's nothing problematic or in tension with other things central to Hegel's project to say that art is one of the ways in which the hold of any notion of being in some way nothing but natural creatures, burdened by a biological destiny, or as he says, befangen, captured by a fixed species essence, is transcended. But in these and many other contexts, he does not qualify his remarks this way and seems to speak instead of a liberation from our sensible embodiment altogether, a hopelessly non-dialectical notion. The idea of being liberated from a nature prison is obviously foreign to the dialectical sweep of most of Hegel's enterprise and the place of the philosophy of nature within his ultimate encyclopedic system, and would make understandable, but not persuasive, some sort of claim that we have reached a kind of self-understanding that transcends our need to understand ourselves aesthetically, as corporeally embodied, understand ourselves sensorially. And a person with such a view might argue that given this achievement, we no longer find the primary sensual experience of ourselves, perceptual, affective, passionate, all that important. That is, the more extreme triumphalist readings of the end of art claim, we don't simply need art as such anymore, presuppose this undialectical formulation. Hegel's confidence that art itself has been transcended, rather than that our current self-understanding requires a radically altered form of art, is clearly tied to such unqualified remarks about liberation. So breaking free of the myth of the given in empiricism, the myth of immediacy in romantic intuitionism, the dualistic myth of mental states causing bodily motions, or of self-reductive naturalisms and so forth, is not breaking free of our own sensible embodiment. What we need is a new intuitive understanding of such embodiment consistent with the sort of freedom we have achieved. And you can see in the quotation that Hegel being Hegel, art by means of its representation while remaining within the sensuous sphere liberates man, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And this is an indication of a blind spot in his treatment of modernity, his failure to anticipate the kind of dissatisfaction what he himself kept calling this prosaic world would generate, or his failure that there might be basic forms of disunion, Entzweiung, or torn apartness, Zerrissenheit, that his project could not account for which there was no sublation or overcoming yet on the horizon. The duality is basically the same one he has been worried about since his Jena period and his first publications. In the aesthetic lectures, he puts it this way in a striking image. Spiritual culture, the modern intellect, produces this opposition in man, which makes him an amphibious animal, because he now has to live in two worlds which contradict one another. He means the world of nature and the world of spirit, the world of necessity and the world of freedom. The result is that now consciousness wanders about in this contradiction, and driven from one side to the other, cannot find satisfaction for itself in either the one or the other. It's striking to note that Hegel does not say here that human beings have been and always will be such amphibious animals, but that spiritual culture, the modern intellect, has produced this wandering soul. The claim returns us yet again to a decisive aspect of Hegel's treatment of the problem of the absolute that we've been stressing. The problem our amphibian faces is not, for Hegel, a metaphysical problem about substance, how immaterial and material could interact. We have produced such a being, der insu amphibi macht, and so the problem our subject faces is not the proper philosophical account of interacting substances, hylomorphism, emergent properties, anomalous monism, all the philosophical dodges of the late 20th century, but a problem he calls the problem of satisfaction, Befriedigung. This, in effect, redefines the problem rather than addresses it in its conventional form. How can a subject of thought and deeds, which always experiences itself as beyond or more than, even though also its material states, come to any resolution about who or what it actually is? How can it find satisfaction in the absence of any such resting place? The premises for this sort of treatment by Hegel, let us say a more practical and metaphysical treatment, are quite complicated, both historically and systematically. Basically, Hegel is not treating the German idealist problem of the absolute, the account of a possible subject-object identity, as a problem of some prior ground to be recovered in some intellectual intuition or aesthetic experience, as in Schelling's project. He follows Schiller, instead in reversing the direction of the question forward, not backwards, where subjectivity is understood as a kind of socially achieved status, a mode of comportment towards each other and the natural world to be achieved, that such a status and practice reconciles and integrates our experiences of ourselves as sensible material creatures as well as minded and active beings. Schiller's useful example is one Hegel also occasionally uses, romantic love, and especially romantic love in the family, which is neither the mere imposing of an ethical form onto brute sexual need, nor a merely instrumental strategy for the satisfaction of such a need. Everything in this tradition of philosophical value comes down to the proper understanding of such a formality, materiality, relation, but what we need now is a general sense of this notion of a reconciled Geist as an accomplishment. Or as Hegel says frequently and mysteriously, Geist, spirit, is a product of itself. But Hegel also, repeating in a different register what I am saying is his cardinal error, now insists, in spite of these amphibian remarks, that philosophy, and only philosophy, has succeeded in overcoming this tension, and it is under that assumption that he ascribes to art the task that leaves so little room for much with any life or interest in it. Against this, we must maintain that art's vocation is to unveil the truth in the form of sensuous artistic configuration, the truth, to set forth the reconciled opposition just mentioned, and so to have its end and aim in itself in this very setting forth and unveiling. Well, if we simply change the key word in that quotation, reconciled, to unreconciled, as by any reasonable account of modernity we must, a different picture of a possibly modern art opens up. But to appreciate Hegel's possible relevance here, consider again the Manet moment, first in the light of traditional accounts of the beautiful and of art prior to Hegel, and then consider Hegel's very different suggestion. It is immediately apparent that philosophical aesthetics from Plato to Kant and Schiller is pretty much helpless with paintings like these by Manet, and eventually, of course, by Cezanne and Miro and Picasso and Pollock and so forth. Clearly, the tone of both of Manet's original revolutionary paintings is far from idealizing. If anything, it is anti-idealizing, even ironic. There is no serious attempt at verisimilitude in the depiction of the sensual properties. Olympia's skin has nothing of Titian's lush, pink, living quality. It even seems a bit dirty and, as many, many commentators noted, almost dead. One even compared it to an inflatable doll. Another said it was like a picture cut out of a print and pasted onto the painting, and so forth. Furious, furious criticism. And so no invitation to any experience of sensual intellectual harmony. As we shall see with more examples in a moment, its effect is rather something like cognitive or musical dissonance, almost as if both paintings were intended as a kind of affront, or at least challenge, turned in toto toward the beholder with a strange flamboyant indifference to that beholder. In a striking departure from what many of you will recognize as Michael Fried's view about the absorptive tradition of the 18th and early 19th century, the subjects in Manet's paintings often look out of the picture frame toward the beholder. Sometimes they just look out, not at the beholder. Sometimes they look out, but without seeing anything, as we'll see examples of in a moment, inviting what would have been theatricality. Here are the contrasting directions of attention in many of Fried's examples. Here, the Chardin, where the absorbed attention of the subject of the painting draws us, the direction of attention, in other words, is deeply into the painting. Nowhere more dramatic than in Jericho's Raft of the Medusa, where we're, in a way, almost sucked in to the incredible vitality of this attempt. It's almost, if you believe Michael's narrative on this, it's almost like he's sort of saying goodbye to absorption, or the possibility to absorption, or these pictures by Millet of this intense, absorbed attention that is clearly allegorizing the attention of the of our putative attention to the painting. But the uncanny effect of the Manet facingness, as Fried calls it, is that such beholders, us, standing right there, are, rather than being there for the painting, as if it's addressing us, as if it's for us, are as if invisible, or at least irrelevant, occupying no important presence in the subject's vacant or bemused look. The suggested absence of even the possibility of mutuality between the subject of the painting and the beholder, suggested by this invisibility or irrelevance or perhaps even contempt, not its simple failure, not just misrecognition, and the air of unmistakable unease that this creates is what helps to suggest the incomplete and fragmentary atmosphere in many of the paintings. It was also very famous in the criticisms of Manet in terms of all the conventions for painterly finish. It's unfinished. There are too many details that haven't been, in effect, smoothed over. And while there are elements of great beauty, oh, that's another fantastic Courbet I forgot to show you, another sort of trope of absorption or of anti-theatricality. While there are elements of great beauty in Manet, Woman in White is a spectacular painting, and even in details like this simple hand, it's in a painting where the bizarreness of Manet is on view again. This is, for no conceivable reason at all, a woman dressed as a toreador. And the picadors in the background are, again, the wrong size, unfinished, sketched. All the dimensions of space are ruined. The background is coming quickly towards the foreground, and so forth. While there are such images of great beauty and a kind of pleasure in the sheer boldness of the painting, maybe even humor, the romantic categories, even the whole notion of the beautiful, now all seem simply beside the point. What would then be the point? I'm tempted to rest my whole case for the relevance of Hegel to these quotations from one passage of the lectures. So conversely, art makes every one of its productions into a thousand-eyed Argus, whereby the inner soul and spirit is seen at every point. And it is not only the bodily form, the look of the eyes, the countenance and postures, but also actions and events, speech and tones of voice, and the series of their course through all conditions of appearance that art has everywhere to make into an eye in which the free soul is revealed in its inner infinity. The idea that visual art can be said to transform the surface of every painted object or depicted object or represented object, even the appearance of actions, events, speeches, and so forth, into a thousand-eyed creature, is also a claim that the reception and appreciation of the artwork should be understood not as an inspiring intimation of the ideal, nor as the occasion of an inner harmony or unusual disinterested pleasure. After all, even when confronted by a two-eyed creature, the task of figuring out what is revealed in someone's eyes is obviously not straightforward or discursive. It can be much more difficult, even, than understanding what they say. A response appropriate to the ambition of the work must therefore be an interpretive accomplishment of sorts, one that begins in some interrogative, not merely sensually receptive or contemplative relation to the object. A feature of the aesthetic experience, Hegel suggests, is spectacularly more difficult than often appreciated by imagining that an artwork is a thousand-eyed Argus. Earlier on, Hegel had characterized all of art in a way that can sound like boilerplate unless we note how unusual the formulation is. Quote, it, the work, is essentially a question, an address to the responsive breast, a call to the mind and spirit. Such an attempt must be responsive to evidence, but it is never settleable by any fact of the matter and always remains open and contentious. Moreover, the image itself suggests that we think of the difference between seeing a painted surface in an artwork and seeing the object itself as like the difference between seeing a person or a person's face as an object like any other and seeing it as a face of a person, requiring a completely different relation between beholder and beheld. This also suggests that there is a deep connection between understanding meaningful conduct, actions, and expressions of purpose, persons, and understanding expressive meaning in artworks as well. And this all at least suggests something more determinate about the distinct category of sensual and especially visual aesthetic intelligibility that Hegel has tried to differentiate from what he calls representational, and that's religion, and conceptual, that's philosophical, intelligibility. Such a form of discrimination, obviously of great relevance to pictorial intelligibility, is certainly not or cannot be wholly non-conceptual in Hegel's account, or a mere material effect. But the modality of its less determinate conceptual determinacy addresses the beholder in a unique and, as he says, interrogative way. Perhaps one small way of understanding Hegel's point is to call to mind a feature of social interaction quite prominent, interestingly, in many modernist novels, the suggestion that there is a unique form of visual intelligibility in the human face. In Proust's novel, Swann can see in Odette's face that she is lying about an assignation. He does not see some evidence on her face on the basis of which he makes an inference. He is said to see the lie in her face. Or in a conversation in a Henry James novel, a character A can see in the face of another character B, see in the face of another character B, not only that B knows that A has revealed some confidence, but that B knows that A knows that B knows. And again, whatever this form of intelligibility is, it is not inferential, is in some literal sense seen, and is at work when a painting arrests us, compels our attention, and raises the kind of question Hegel has noted. That is, as Hegel understands it, the making and especially the displaying of artworks cannot but express an underlying assumption about the possibility of some public meaning, and so involves the status and role of the beholder, any putative addressee of such an expression of meaning. This assumption would have to be congruent with assumptions about agency, a possibly public meaning embodied in bodily movements, and about those for whom such a display is intended, at least on the assumption that such a performative and public dimension is at the heart of Hegel's account of subjectivity in agency, too. That's the analogy I would like to press. And given the way Hegel approaches such questions, we have to say that he means the satisfaction of these aesthetic and performative conditions at a time, that is, in our time, under the conditions of modernity. If this is a feature of art now as such, then it might also be said that under some historical conditions, the capacity to fulfill these requirements in both its manifestations, social and agentive and aesthetic, could come to be experienced as deeply problematic, or at least a great deal more difficult, requiring a different sort of relation between beholder and beheld, agent and others, than ever before, a new relation that is more an aspiration than a presentiment. Then something like the resistance of much modernist work to conventional appreciation and interpretation, the unfamiliarity and opacity we often see in its thousand eyes, can be understood as something like the culmination of this difficulty, now made much more explicitly self-conscious and insistent, and so is responsive to altered conditions of such public intelligibility. The same could be said, mutatis mutandis, for the aspirations of much of modernism to forge a new and revolutionary understanding of these conditions, to demand that we understand each other and thereby understand and appreciate art in a new way. This is the Hegelian link I want to insist we should retain in an aesthetic theory, even if we abandon, as we should, Hegel's triumphalism. And to make the point in a more literal rather than figurative sense, where else is the beholder's eye drawn in the two Manet paintings than to the face and expressions of the two naked women? Both expressions seem opaque and even somewhat contemptuous of the beholder's own gaze, raising the stakes considerably in trying to answer what is expressed in their eyes. This sort of question is particularly important in Manet because there is so often an air of mystery and opacity in the expressions of his subjects in different contexts and in the unusual settings, a challenge that resists direct, immediate narrative understanding as if designed to prevent now inappropriate conventional readings. Some of these expressions are quite famous, not just these two, but the expression of fatigue and especially the vacancy in the expression of the girl in the bar at the Folies Bergère. But these eyes, in very different kinds of modalities, are everywhere in Manet. This is one that Clark gives a particularly stupendous reading of, where he notes, I mean, you know, she's not listening to him, obviously. She's looking out at the painting again, but with the kind of vacancy that seems to, I think, allegorize something of the possible reception of the painting itself. It also has something that Foucault, in his lectures in 68 in Algeria, was just as obsessed with as a formalist critic like Greenberg, that is, as a way of calling attention to the flatness of the canvas. Instead of destroying the illusion that we're seeing a painted rectangle, Manet will often emphasize a horizontal and vertical line to reframe inside the painting itself. And he'll often, not so dramatically here, but very often bring the background of the painting forward to emphasize this as well. Even in these bizarre religious paintings, which have also quite controversial because Christ had never been depicted that way, there's the same mysterious vacancy in the eye of the angel, not now looking out towards us, but again, looking without seeing. I think a French critic at the time correctly characterized what's going on. This is one that when it isn't loaned out, you can actually see at Chicago, but it seems to be always somewhere else. And then these striking, both in the Metropolitan of New York and in Chicago, these striking enigmatic, and even his parents get this kind of treatment. This is a spectacular painting. But again, you know, vertical, horizontal, and the tantalizing intimations of depth, but then all pushed forward so that you can barely see the waiter carrying something in the background and the same kind of looks. So I think, again, I would not like to interpret psychologically or even sociopolitically, but rather as kind of allegories of the expectation of the painting, of the placing in suspension a certain kind of interchange between the beholder and beheld under the new conditions under which easel painting must be reconfigured. This is a fantastic painting in Berlin, but again, a kind of unreadable expression. And I don't want to claim that this is only in Manet. He doesn't have any copyrights. This is Whistler's famous White Woman, which disturbed quite a lot of people. They thought she was mad. I don't think she looks particularly crazy, but that's a very frequent reaction to the extremity of the wildness of the painting. And even Degas has a lot of these, which are clearly more socio-historically inflected, like this one. So other people were using this trope in a way, but it's the extraordinary repetition of the theme in Manet that makes it almost a mythological donné. Once that issue is dramatically in play, then every other aspect of the painting becomes a question. In Hegel's terms, an eye, a face in the same way. Why naked at a picnic? Why are the men talking past each other? Why do they seem to ignore her? What does the position of the gesture of Olympia's left hand, you can't believe how controversial this was at the time. because her hand appears slightly tense. That bothered people, and they knew it was a reference, an echo to the Venus d'Urbino, but I should think they'd be more bothered by this one, that they were bothered by that one. Why a black cat? Why the flowers? And finally, under what historical conditions would this aspect of a painting's meaning, a kind of puzzled resistance to direct appreciation, even a somewhat contemptuous challenge to the beholder's expectation of meaning, become so thematized so frequently and so problematically? Okay, one section left, rounding up. One reads frequently that the issue in modernist painting has a great deal to do with the so-called problem of subjectivity. And this certainly seems connected with the problem crudely sketched before as the idealist problem with the absolute. Bataille has a famous little book on Manet in which he talks about the sort of receding subjectivity. You sort of see it vanishing. It becomes less and less present as we move towards the completely de-psychologized constructions of analytic cubism that erupt after Cézanne. Such a problem certainly has something to do in painting after the Renaissance with working out what it means now to paint gallery pictures, easel paintings that could move about for beholders to be sold. What assumptions about the mindedness of beholders, their expectations about interpretability and meaning, and the portrayal of human mindedness in the painting. All of that is now relevant now that various institutional contexts and assumptions no longer inform the interaction between painter and beholder as they once did. I have claimed that we can begin to develop a Hegelian understanding of post-Hegelian art if we take into account his project as a whole and appreciate the limitations of his diagnosis of the state of modern societies. So what, in his terms, did he fail to see, and how is that apparent in an art that, thereby, he could not have appreciated had he even seen it? Here is one of his most sweeping characterizations of the state of late Romantic art, art in the process of becoming something past. Yet there is something higher than the beautiful appearance of spirit in immediate sensuous shape, even if this shape be created by spirit as adequate to itself. For this unification, which is achieved in the medium of externality, and therefore makes sensuous reality into an appropriate existence of spirit, nevertheless is once more opposed to the true essence of spirit, with the result that spirit is pushed back into itself, out of its reconciliation with the corporeal, into a reconciliation with itself, of itself with itself. It's already controversial to suggest that this is on the right track at all. There are many, Adorno, for example, who argue for some retrieval or memory of sensuous particularity and immediacy as the proper function of modernist art, and who see in such statements the signs of identity thinking in Hegel. I agree with Hegel, though, that framed this way, this would be a romantic regression and is not borne out in the trajectory of the aspirations of modernist art. But what then is spirit's reconciliation of itself with itself, such that the failure of this reconciliation illuminates anything about painting after Hegel? In the painting tableau, we are restricted to the visible surfaces of things under certain conditions of light and shadow, of human faces and bodies frozen in moments of time in action. If the tableau depicts people, then the question of the meaning of what they're doing, simply the right act description, arises immediately. Pre-modernist art, we are usually aided by the title, the names of the persons portrayed, and perhaps some standard biblical or historical setting. But we must try to understand various gestural moments and something about the organization of the space within the picture frame even so. Why just that way? As was noted in discussing the Argus passage, to a certain very general extent, we can say that the complex relation between the materiality of paint itself and painterly meaning mirrors or echoes the possibility of the relationship between visible corporeal surface and human intentionality generally, and it can give rise to the same skeptical problems. We can say that we take the painted surfaces that we see to mean what they do in something like, we might want to say, we comprehend the mindedness we take to be expressed in corporeal movement and visible facial surface. But again, the way we do so is not fixed as a kind of eternal Platonic problem, and it is not a two-step process. We ascribe intention, motive, reaction, and purpose in ways broadly governed by norms at a time. In perhaps the most spectacularly obvious case, coming to see persons, see them immediately, not as primarily instances of psychological types or representative of family destiny or as exemplifications of a natural social class, but as absolutely distinct individuals first and foremost, is an ascription of meaning with a complex modern history that is a stupendous historical achievement. This ascription of meaning is not, again, an inferential or two-stage relation, and therewith is painting's great advantage as an art. We don't see bodily movements and then infer intentions, any more than we see painted canvases and infer represented objects and intended meaning. But such intelligibility is a conceptual articulation that is an achievement of some sort. Understanding what we see is always, in some sense, provisional and revisable, especially contestable with others, and that characteristic is an aspect inherent in seeing or understanding itself. In the simplest sense, not being able to do this with any confidence anymore is what it means for there to be no reconciliation of spirit with itself, no confident self-understanding in the face of contesting claims, or in the face of a confusion about how in such a world even to begin to try, even what might bear the meaning with which we would try. The ultimate expression of this is this very, very famous sort of prophecy by Manet of what's coming in painting, the execution of Maximilian, where you get this echo of Goya's famous execution painting. But again, you get the violation of perspective. The victims are way too close. The rifles are right on top of them, giving the painting a kind of jarring, sensual, visual, dissonant air. There's an intimation of space, but it's brought forward by the kids who are sitting on the wall. The kind of brutality of the anonymity of the shooters, which is the same in the Goya painting, all makes this a very difficult narrative. But Manet, in order to make it more difficult, almost impossible, dips his brush in a can of red paint and puts in the painting a completely non-representational mark, as if he's prophesying that painting would become that paint on a canvas. So the absence of animated subjectivity in those expressions is not a sign, I think, of some discovery about the true absence of human subjectivity in favor of merely corporeal bodies, but the failure of the historical world to allow for the realization of such subjectivity in the only way it can become actual, corporeally or lived. Summarized one last time, I am suggesting that Hegel is asking us to understand the social meaning of individual actions in the way he understands the historical and social dimensions of the production and appreciation of artworks, and especially in this context, vice versa. We are willing to concede, or at least more willing to concede, that an artwork can be said to embody the artist's intention, what she must have intended given what is there, in a way not at all tied to what explicit intentions the artist herself might have been able to formulate. And we understand that artworks mean what they do only within the institution of art in a society at a period. There is, of course, great commonality across epochs and societies, but we also struggle with historical works to understand what they meant at a time, in an age, as well as for us. I think it is clear that Hegel thinks of actions as having such a public, performative, and so socio-historical dimension. Something like the realization of this is what turning the painting plane and the expressions of the depicted subjects so confrontationally toward the beholder raises as a challenge. This feature means that agents can sincerely avow intentions which are not in or even are contradicted by the deed as that deed comes to mean what it does for others at a time, and that individual agents no more own the appropriate act description for what they've done than artists have proprietary relations with the meaning of what they've produced. To be beset with such worries is to fail to achieve reconciliation with oneself. In this context, we might say that just to the extent that under new, rapidly changing historical conditions, we come to be more dubious, unsure, or confused about the sense we make in seeing intentions in deeds, the less confident we are that we know how to do this, the less stable we might also expect the conventions governing pictorial success might be. The mark of this challenge and this difficulty is captured in those vacant looks in so many Manets and in many others, and in the implicit paradox that on the one hand, the subjects sometimes are looking right at the beholder, but on the other hand, they seem to have no hope in a beholder's response. They confront the beholder, but as if he or she were not there, as if they do not expect, could now not expect, anything satisfying in return. By success in this gesture, I mean that the modernist equivalent to beauty as the promise of happiness is the promise of meaning, perhaps under ever more intense pressure. In these paintings, it's a promise that frames the paintings, but is not, perhaps can't be realized within the frame. That appears to be the point. An apt name for what it means to fail to acknowledge and appreciate the situation properly is the one made such fruitful use of by Fried, Diderot's theatricality, and a brilliant early exposition of the increasingly unsecured nature of mutual interpretability, its constant possible fraudulence, is Diderot's famous Rameau's nephew. But Hegel himself, in his greatest failure, never seemed very concerned about this potential instability in the modern world, about citizens of the same ethical commonwealth potentially losing so much common ground and common confidence that a general irresolvability in any of these possible conflicts becomes ever more apparent, the kind of high challenge and low expectations we see in all those vacant looks. As we've seen, he doesn't worry much because of his general theory about the gradual actual historical achievement of some mutual recognitive status, a historical claim that has come to look like the least plausible aspect of Hegel's account and that is connected with our resistance to his proclamations about art as a thing of the past. Since freedom is in Hegel's expressive account has to do with an ability to see myself successfully in my own deeds, experience them as legitimately mine, stand behind them, defend them, a growing skepticism or uncertainty about being able to do this might be expected to cast its skeptical shadow on various other forms of embodied expressions of human meaning. This is what it is to see what Hegel missed, but to see it in his terms, and make use of that to understand the conditions of modern painterly meaning. Hegel's sense of the successful resolution of the question raised by trying to understand someone's deed or by the question posed by a thousand-eyed Argus has both a subjective and an objective side, both a way of understanding the provisional and unstable subjective side, the intention, motive, or reason, a meaning actual only in the deed or in the aesthetic object, and the objective social conditions of an age, especially the struggle for recognition inherent in social conflict, and the ever more unstable interpretive conventions of modern societies. It is now generally acknowledged that Hegel's understanding of these objective social conditions was way too prematurely optimistic, to say the least. But his account of what we need to take account of in understanding subjective intention and meaning, and his insistence on a link with the objective conditions, remains a kind of modern fate, and one that needs to be set inside the later context of the fractured and prosaic character of the emerging industrialized, bourgeois, eventually consumerist nation-state world coming into view in the 19th century. We get an intuitive view of the result in different ways in different 19th century painters after The Beautiful. Thanks very much for your patience.